So nice to have you back, Gilbert.
Well, it's good to be back.
And let's get started with Russia's policy in terms of the new strategy, the new nuclear strategy of Russia, and how it sees the United States policy in this new strategy. What's your take on this?
Well, there has been a lot of commentary in Western media about the changed Russian nuclear doctrine. There are those like Jens Stoltenberg, which would have you believe that nothing has changed and that Russia's red lines are meaningless. There are others who are a bit more insightful and a bit more honest, who see a dramatic change and who understand the Russians are saying their red lines will be honored or there'll be a war. Very little attention has gone into why. Why did this come up now, other than some need to be tough? Mr. Putin was under pressure, and so he responded to domestic pressures by toughening the Russian stance on use of tactical and strategic nuclear weapons. There's something else that was available to us all, but very few of my colleagues have used it, and that was the clear indication when Russia and Mr. Putin rolled out the new doctrine that is based on a new evaluation of the threat from the United States. The long-standing threat was a global strike. The United States had set up various both satellites and missile systems to stage a global strike that would be decapitating against its enemy, had invested heavily in this. The Russians, in the meantime, had invested not so heavily, but still substantial resources to frustrate such an attack if it were made. However, what Russia is saying now, looking closely at American and NATO behavior in Ukraine, is that the United States has moved away from that, because it is what the United States had built up in many respects was bypassed by latest Russian strategic offensive and defensive weapon systems. And the United States has moved into a new strategy for holding its global dominance and for crushing the most important adversaries that it has, as it sees it, Russia and China. And that is using hybrid wars, using proxy wars. And that we know that everyone has acknowledged that the war in Ukraine is a proxy war of the United States, in brackets NATO, against Russia. But now, let's add to that. What's going on in the Middle East is also a proxy war by the United States. I was listening a few minutes ago to the latest interview that Colonel McGregor has given on the situation in the Middle East. I have the highest respect for the expertise, the military expertise that he brings to his commentaries. And I gather from his interviews useful material for my own work, just as I gather useful material from the work of Scott Ritter. Although I make critical comments on these and other of my peers, we are all operating out of our own methodologies, and it's no need to look for identical conclusions if we're using different methodologies for our analysis. Now, Colonel McGregor was saying that the United States seems to be flying blind in the Middle East. It is not leading events, it is following events. And this is very dangerous for the American people. On reconsideration, I think he's wrong. I think the United States is fully in command of what's going on, because they are using Israel the same way they are using Ukraine. And they will fight in the Middle East to the last Israeli. The Israeli economy is wrecked, just as the Ukrainian economy is wrecked, to a lesser extent by any externally administered infrastructure damage. That hasn't happened yet. But as we know, the war has taken a very big toll on the Israeli economy, not just because its men-at-arms are essentially the managers and the workers of its industry and economy, but because its ports have been made unsafe, because supplies of vital hydrocarbons and other resources have been endangered by strikes from Houthis and other adversaries. So the Israeli economy is suffering. But I don't want to get distracted by that. The main point is that the United States was behind the attacks, the latest attacks in Lebanon. They were impossible without the American inputs. And so these were American planes. These were American intelligence, AWACS off the coast, supplying the Israelis with all they needed to know of where to drop them, the bombs, and the bombs themselves, the two-ton bombs, 86 of which were dropped on six apartment buildings downtown Beirut, one after another, going through layer, till they reached the safe havens of their enemies in Hezbollah. Those bombs were American. And of course, what we're talking about is, as I see it, a kind of revenge by those same people in the deep state who gave us the war in Iraq, which was a disaster at the end, who gave us the Afghan war, which was a humiliation at the end. And these same neocons have not left the power levers in Washington, the influencers in Congress, and they are looking for, and they are now achieving, their revenge for the humiliations that the United States has experienced in the last 20 years as a result of their policies, of the never-ending wars that they have inflicted on others for the purpose of maintaining American global dominance. Well, this reality struck a chord in Moscow. The Russians understood this perfectly. They seem to have understood it better than Colonel McGregor, although he was rather disparaging of Moscow's ability to interpret events in his latest remarks. No, the United States is behind the war in the Middle East, and it is using Israel to maintain its global dominance throughout the Middle East and to recover its stature from the, as I say, series of humiliations in the recent wars that the United States instigated illegally and lost in a quite ugly manner. So the Russians have understood this, and therefore they have changed their nuclear doctrine to accommodate it to the new facts. The new facts are that the United States will stand back, will use its allies, its proxies, to do whatever it wants to do against Russia or China, and to stand back with clean hands and say, oh, don't touch us, we weren't involved in this, as you see from all the latest denials coming out of Mr. Kirby and his fellow spokesman for one or another group in the United States leadership. No, the United States is in it up to its neck, and it has taken great pleasure in facilitating the Israeli reign of havoc and destruction in its neighborhood.
And the question is, to what extent do they want to continue the conflict in the Middle East? Because with this ground offensive on the part of Israelis, it doesn't seem that would be successful. And are they willing to sacrifice Israel the way they have been sacrificing Ukraine?
You answered your own question. Yes, of course they are. The United States is very selfish and very cruel. And despite all of the talk about the brotherhood with relations with Israel and how we stand up for them and we don't forget the Holocaust and the rest of it, they're not us. They're not the United States. And the United States will sacrifice them without a moment's hesitation to achieve what it believes to be its supreme objective of global domination.
Yeah. And do you think that the way that they're trying to attack Russian base in Syria. Do you find it related to what's going on between Iran and Hezbollah, or it's something else, is totally different aspects?
Well, there are assets of the major powers in West Asia. The biggest assets, of course, are American assets. And I think that any American encouragement of or facilitation of attacks in Syria are in this, must be seen in this context, because American assets have been struck by the allies of the axis of resistance that Iran maintains. So it's tit for tat. And that being said, Iran has much greater capability, both itself and through its fellow fighters in the region, to damage the vast resources that the United States has sitting there as sitting ducks. The most obvious sitting ducks, of course, are the aircraft carrier task force in the Eastern Med. But there are the bases, the Fifth Fleet base in the region. There are American troops almost everywhere in those countries, and all of them can be struck by missiles from the Houthis, not from Hezbollah so far, but certainly from Iran. And everyone's taking their time. What's going on in the Middle East is also a confirmation of conclusions that I've reached with respect to the Ukraine war. That is, why is Mr. Putin so slow to react? Why has he allowed so many red lines to be crossed? Why did it take till now before the Russians have drawn a line in the sand and said definitely, we will attack you, United States, if you cross this line? I think what we have to consider is that both on the Russian side and on the United States side, there's like two scorpions that are circling one another. The both of these parties do not want to be drawn into a World War III. That being said, the Russians have a greater restraint on them than the Americans do. The Americans are the unchallenged leader of NATO and of another 20 countries that have joined in, for example, on the anti-Russian campaign in Ukraine. The Russians don't have that kind of dominance among their sympathizers, let's call it, China, India, the global South. Russia does not have that dominance. It's gaining that dominance, thanks to American, very ill-advised, very stupid, very ignorant American policies that have pushed China into Russia's arms and just pushed Iran into Russia's arms. Now, what I'm saying now may sound like the unusual understanding of the man biting the dog. The dog usually bites the man, and the dog biting the man is the assumption throughout Washington that the Ukraine war has forced Russia into Chinese arms, and that they have made rather expensive for themselves deals on raised exports of hydrocarbons to China. That they are dependent on China for various commercial assistance, which makes them a junior partner in the relationship. That's what we usually hear from everybody else. I'm saying now the situation is exactly reversed because of what Washington has done, because of the efforts to build a Pacific NATO, because of the agreements with South Korea, Japan, Australia, and hope for other members in an anti China coalition, right at the borders, and to station these medium range nuclear armed missiles against China there. Before whom you said that the Chinese didn't want Russia to go under because they would be next, it was a statement of a general observer of what we supposed could be going on. What we see now is not a question of somebody's arbitrary interpretation. The United States, by leading a trade war against China, by forcing allies to restrict or prohibit sale of advanced chip-making equipment to China, and by encouraging the EU to follow quickly with similar anti-Chinese trade measures, is trying to strike at the jugular of the Chinese economy and of the Communist Party rule in China. And that cannot go on without China changing its policies towards the United States now, not 5 years from now. That's going on as we speak. And the result, as I say, is that China needs Russia more than Russia needs China right now. Russia has solved its trade problems out of the sanctions with India more than with China. The Chinese, though, need the defensive systems like the S-400 or S-500 that the Russians have developed, and other weapons that China has which are essential to maintain Chinese defense against a very aggressive neighborhood led by the United States. Iran, under the newly elected moderate, reform-minded prime minister, was speaking 2 weeks ago about wanting to reopen the talks with the signatories to the comprehensive agreement on a nuclear settlement and relaxing the sanctions on the Iranian economy. That was 2 weeks ago. What the United States has done by facilitating the Israeli attacks in Lebanon on Hezbollah is by the decapitation strike in downtown Beirut was to leave the new presidency and his advisors with no choice but to respond in a way that heads towards a regional war and that makes essential the close military assistance that Russia is giving to Iran in the defense weapon systems. This is something that Scott Ritter has spoken about extensively, and I salute his remarks, particularly the notion that the advanced fighter jets that Russia is giving to Iran may very likely be piloted by Russians, and that the S-400s that are now in Iran to protect them against Israeli strikes are very likely manned by Russians, or very least have Russian technicians and advisors next to the Iranian crews who are operating the systems. Why? Well, the very same reason why there are Americans operating the Patriot systems in Kiev. These systems are very sophisticated and they take a long time to train qualified staff, and the time isn't there. So the manufacturers of the systems have to be present to ensure that they will function properly on the ground. So there, we can assume safely that if there is going to be an Israeli air attack on Iran, the Israeli planes will be shot down by Russians. That's where things stand now.
Yeah. And the other thing in the Middle East would be other countries. How do you see Turkey and Saudi Arabia in terms of what's going on? Do you find it that they're getting what's going on the way that you were describing it, or they're seeing something else?
Well, the predicaments of these countries are specific to the countries. Turkey is the most complicated because of its NATO membership. I think that very quickly its continued presence in NATO will become impossible for Turkey. If as we closer we come to a regional war, the less tenable is Turkey's membership in NATO, because NATO, or the leaders of NATO, are driving the attack on Turkey's allies in the neighborhood by their blood and religious brothers. Now, will Turkey take part actively now? I don't think so. Are they going to become co-belligerents? I don't think so. Mr. Erdogan talks big and does very little. He's sitting on the fence for obvious reasons. But I think let's wait until the dust settles. As for Saudi Arabia, they are on the sidelines. They have changed their fundamental policy from being in favor of the Abraham Accords and reaching a settlement with Israel. They have, in their latest statements, they deny that they will make any peace with Israel until there is a two-state solution in place. But will Saudi Arabia engage in the war? Their defenses, even with American assistance, are inadequate. The Houthis, I apologize for this noise. I'm in my apartment, and some neighboring apartments have decided to do renovations. But I hope that my voice nonetheless carries over this background noise. The Houthis demonstrated that Saudi Arabia was vulnerable in its most sensitive place, in its oil processing facilities, refineries, and of course in its pumping facilities. So that if a group as poorly equipped as the Houthis could achieve that, it's clear that the Saudis are not going to go up against Israel. However, I'd like to call out the more important fact, as I see it. Though these countries in the neighborhood of the conflict will not sign up with Iran today against Israel, states in general go for winners and abandon losers. And if the conflict ends, as it may very well end, with serious damage to Israel's military reputation, let's not say defeat, because a defeat in obvious terms will be prevented at all costs by the United States. But if Israel takes a beating in this conflict, then the neighborhood will move against Israel. In its geopolitical positions, meaning in every international forum. This cannot be underestimated. Russia has picked up friends and friends. The BRICS is going from strength to strength because of Russia's apparent victory against all of NATO in Ukraine. As I say, states are not unlike individual humans in this respect. We all want to be on the side of a winner.
We know that there would be a comprehensive military agreement between Russia and Iran. And how do you see this agreement going to a security agreement between these two countries? Because the way that we're witnessing what's going on in the Middle East, and how is it connected to the conflict in Ukraine, It seems that would be the case at the end of the day.
Well, as others who are more competent than I am to judge the military capabilities of Iran are saying, Iran is doing quite all right with offensive weapons. With missiles seem to be include Mach 10, which is really fully hypersonic missiles that are, you can't even detect them when they're coming in. And so in that respect, Iran doesn't need help. But on the defense side and on the Air Force side, Iran is deficient and Russia is by no means deficient. This is why the dispatch of these highly advanced air defense systems to Iran is of major importance. And clearly, the Russians could not supply enough of their systems to cover all of the assets that are an infrastructure that are of value, of great value to the Iranian economy and state. So there's plenty of room for further development of this once the security agreement is signed and implemented. It is expected that the signature will take place during the BRICS summit in Kazan, which is 25th, 24th, 26th of this month.
Yeah. And talking about the conflict in Ukraine right now, we had Zelensky visiting the United States talking with Biden and then with Donald Trump. Two different meetings totally in terms of the concept and the way they were talking about the conflict. How did you find it?
Well, I have not much to say about Mr. Biden and his people around or about Kamala Harris. They are all in on a failed policy of supporting a dictator in Kiev, a dictator who has played a decisive role in military strategy that has not turned out well for his country. Most recently, the Kursk invasion of Russia that has taken a very bad turn and been very costly to the Ukrainian military. As for Mr. Trump, the situation is a bit more difficult to understand or explain. He's a man known for bluster. He's a man known for exaggerated statements of one kind or another. He has backed away a little bit from his statements going back a month or more ago, that if elected, he would proceed directly to bang heads together and to find a peace in Ukraine in a day's time. Well, I don't hear about a day's time anymore, but he's still saying that he would be the person to achieve a peace between these parties that is escapes Mr. Biden and Kamala Harris because of their and ill-informed support for Zelensky and his military adventure. I don't believe for a minute that Mr. Trump has the ability to bind his together, or to use his charm with Mr. Putin, or threats on Mr. Putin to bring an end to the war. Nothing of the sort. But having said that, Trump does have the ability to end the war in, say, 2 weeks' time, simply by pulling the plug on all further U.S. military equipment and financial contributions to Ukraine. In a matter of a week or two, the Ukrainian army would grind to a halt and collapse. That, in that sense, what Kamala Harris is saying about Trump is correct. Trump would, by withholding support, force a capitulation on Kiev. Is that a bad thing? No, it's a wonderful thing for the Ukrainian nation, because continuation of this war is a disaster for the nation. It is They have lost maybe 40% of their population to, as refugees abroad. The larger proportion of that going to Russia, and there's still a very significant proportion going to refugees. From where the refugees will not return. Therefore, the Ukraine to continue to exist as an independent nation desperately needs an end to this war now. And all talk of NATO, the outgoing Jens Stoltenberg, the incoming Rutte, that their support will go on indefinitely, all of that is very cynical and heartless destruction of Ukraine as a people and as a state. So in this sense, the moral high ground is with Mr. Trump. I hope that that may be appreciated by some of the voters. But to say that his negotiating skills, his art of the deal, will be behind the peace treaty is utter nonsense.
And the situation in Ukraine and the way that Zelensky is trying to manage the situation, if he's trying to do that. And it seems that right now within the government, we had all of Zelensky and the foreign minister of Ukraine. Right now, the head of intelligence is talking about resigning. And how do you see, because at the end of the day, it's important what's going on in Ukraine in terms of any sort of equation that the United States is putting on the table.
Of course, there are changes in the Ukrainian ranking and top administration. This is understandable. Mr. Zelensky is trying to find scapegoats for the various failures of his government and of his military. The United States is encouraging this because the United States will want to replace Mr. Zelensky himself at the first opportunity to give a fresh start to the failed adventure in Ukraine. But at the end of the day, it is hard to see that Mr. Zelensky will stay in his post. If he were to enter into talks for peace, meaning capitulation, he would be on the first plane out because he would be a dead man walking in Kiev. The extreme nationalists have said explicitly they'll murder him, and I think he is too smart a dude to test that will and ability of his comrade in arms.
Yeah, and right now in the European Union, recently Macron was talking about the priorities of the United States. He said that the first priority is the United States itself, and then it's China. And how, if they understand what's going on between the United States, considering the conflict in Ukraine, and they know what would be the priority of the United States, why they're not trying to find a solution for their benefit in the European Union? And recently they're talking about that the main threat to France is Russia. How is that, how we can put all of this together if the main threat is Russia and they're trying to understand the behavior of the United States the way that they're describing it? And do they have any sort of substantial understanding on what's going on?
I think they don't. The understanding of what is happening in Ukraine is very limited here. Bad news is considered to be disinformation. There is a lot of censorship in Europe, much more than in the United States. There is no division of the public, by the public I mean the politically active public, in Europe the way there is in the United States. And therefore, there is no big effort to explain the situation variously. It's all explained in accordance with the Washington narrative here in Europe. There is, of course, a growing skepticism about that narrative. Even when you pick up the New York Times or the Financial Times, and you see very frank and open reporting on the disastrous situation in the front in Ukraine, on the level of deaths of those who were newly recruited and sent to the front. This is all frankly stated now. It's not alternative media that are providing this to the public, but it is not so much in the European media. And the European leadership is split, as we know, but the not 50-50. It's maybe 75 in favor of the failing policies of today and 25% rising who are opposing it. These 25% are generally denounced as extremist rightists, which is a very convenient form of slander against parties that are not extremist at all. They're simply expressing the popular discontent with the failed policies of existing leadership. And that is shown in the elections in the two states, well, three states now, of what was East Germany, latest being Brandenburg, and where the traffic light coalition of Mr. Schulz has failed badly. The Greens have been trashed, and the Social Democrats have done very, very poorly. The SPD. So there is a movement in the public that finds some expression at the ballot box, but has not been sufficient to overturn the ruling majority and the very censorious policies of the governments, which make it difficult to articulate in public space what you and I are talking about.
Yeah. And the way, in your opinion, in the eyes of Russians right now, they're thinking of the conflict in Ukraine as it's going to continue for years, or they know that they can put an end to this conflict as soon as possible?
Well, it is hard to say with certainty what is genuine change of policy and what is symbolic. The symbolic part, if you want to call it that, is the increase in the Russian military budget for 2025, I think around 30%. If you look at it, look backwards a bit, 2-3 years ago, the Russian military budget planned for 2025 is double the Russian military budget before the start of the special military operation. And of course, the formal Russian military budget does not include a lot of spending on security forces, which one could also consider military spending. So Russia now is, I think it's going to have something like $150 or $160 billion allocated directly to the military. It is raising the latest numbers put out for the Russian armed forces has been raised by another 180,000 men. Russia is bulking up to do what you just said, to go as long as necessary within this war against NATO on the territory of Ukraine. That is a preparation. Preparation doesn't mean that you anticipate that it will be used. You are doing that as a deterrent to ensure that it doesn't have to be used. Therefore, to say exactly what the Kremlin is thinking would be impossible. Do they seriously intend this war to go on for years, the same way that Mr. Stoltenberg does? I doubt it. I think they're looking to a much earlier solution to this, assuming a collapse of Western will, whether that starts in Europe with the unwinding of the German and the French governments and the inability of successor governments to provide any aid of importance to Ukraine, or whether it's the United States elections, which change the single biggest supporter of Ukraine today, the United States. But the Russians have good reason to expect the war to end sooner rather than later. Nonetheless, they do not expect the United States to disappear, to go into hiding, to hide under a rock. They expect the conflict with the United States to emerge and reemerge in various places, as it's now doing in the Middle East, where very shortly, if this conflict becomes regional, if Iran becomes genuinely engaged, then Russia will be engaged and engaged against whom? Essentially against the United States again. So the Russian need for a large army is justified by its evaluation of world trends, and not just in the locality of Ukraine.
Yeah. And do you find it right now on the battlefield? How do you see the situation? Is Russia going to take more territories, or they're just satisfied with what's already in the hand of Russians?
I would have a difficult time answering that question if I only based myself on this morning's New York Times or Financial Times, because they're telling you, yes, the Russians have just taken Ufadar and they're moving in on Pokrovsk. And these are very important centers of logistics and support for the Ukrainian forces. But at the same time, the Russians have had massive losses in this operation. Their army is tired the same way the Ukrainian army is tired. And so everybody's looking for an exit. Well, if that's your news for the morning, then you'd have a hard time answering your question. But if you listen to more generally accepted news of the developments, the Russians are rolling on at great expense in terms of planning, effort, munitions, logistical supplies. Human lives, difficult to judge. I think it is safe to guess still the Russians have between 5 and 10 to 1 advantage in terms of casualties compared to what Ukraine is experiencing. And that is explained by the very cautious approach. Oh, it's a read in the New York Times. Yeah, they are repeating propaganda from Ukraine, which almost always is a mirror image of what we know from Russian sources. The Russians are telling us that the Ukrainians are sending human waves. And then the next day, Ukrainians are saying the Russians are sending human waves and sacrificing the lives of their soldiers to achieve minimal results. These results are no longer called minimal. Talk about Russian will to take the military action to victory, achievement of its goals from the outset. I think it's very clear that is what they're doing and what they will succeed in doing. However, I just have caution against the titles that are given to interviews by my peers. Not necessarily what my peers are saying, but what those who try to attract reader attention to what they're saying, that the Russia is steamrolling them, that the end of the war is near. No, the end of the war is not near, except if there is a breakdown in support for Ukraine, or if there is, by some weird chance, a coup d'etat in Kiev by the military over the civilian leadership. The war can go on for a long time, in theory, not in practice, because the Russians don't really intend to go beyond the Dnieper. And they could leave Ukraine as a rump state on the other side of the Dnieper. Perhaps the Russians will, if they have to proceed at greater length, at more time in this fight, will take Odessa and Nikolaevsk, and they will deprive the rump Ukraine of a seacoast. That's all possible. But the rest of the territory of Ukraine, the Russians have no interest in taking that. They just want to see that is militarily neutralized. And they may very well achieve that. I expect they will. In what time frame? A bit difficult to say. As the it will not be decided on the battlefield, it will be decided in the global capitals.
It seems that at the end of the day, it would be necessary for Russia to make a buffer zone between what's the eastern part of Ukraine that now part of Russia and the western part of Ukraine until they get to a political settlement, or maybe in the aftermath of any sort of political settlement, they do need a buffer zone between the eastern and the western part. How do you find, do you think, have Russians started thinking about it?
Well, I think this question would be better posed after November 5th, because how the American elections go will have a decisive say in whether the war ends very quickly or not so quickly. Buffer zone would be necessary if the war is going to go on. It would not be necessary if Ukraine is facing an imminent capitulation.
Yeah. And just to wrap up this session, yesterday there was an article in the Hill, and it says that why do Russians appear so satisfied despite the war in Ukraine? And you've mentioned New York Times and these people who are thinking that Russia is losing and all of that, but there are people who are confused with what Russia is doing and why they're so satisfied with the situation. What would be your answer to them?
The answer to that came out about a month ago in the Financial Times of all places. As I indicated, the Financial Times is very deeply committed to the Ukrainian victory and to a Russian defeat, but not all their journalists are on side of that. And they had a very lengthy article on why life is so good in Russia now, the prosperity that this war has brought to the Russian working class. That is, where salaries have spiraled and gone up very rapidly, where they enjoy a great many benefits and subsidies from the government, subsidized mortgages. We all know that Russia has an 18 or 19% interest rate set by the Russian National Bank. But mortgages to young families or to privileged professions like school teachers or medical workers, these are just a few percent a year. The shopping basket of the Russian middle class and working class, more important, the working class, has been doing very well since the start of this war. There's a labor shortage. People in menial jobs, people who are truck drivers or taxi drivers or whatever, they are earning several times what they were making before this war began. And so that gives you a feel-good factor, which is also adding to a patriotic fervor that the invasion of Kursk sparked. It's one thing for Russians to be sent for geopolitical interests abroad, across the frontier into Ukraine. It's another thing for Russians to be fighting on their own soil. And that has been a great spur to national patriotism. So between the patriotism coming out of defending your own country and the feeling of prosperity, that's not a feeling, but a reality, as detailed in the Financial Times. That explains the phenomenon that you were asking about.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Gilbert, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thanks for having me.